Time Stands Still, the new play from Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Donald Margulies, centers on a couple, Sarah and James, a photographer and a journalist who covered conflict until physical and psychological injuries sustained in Iraq forced them to return home. On February 8, 2010, the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma brought Margulies together with a real-life couple of married journalists, Santiago Lyon and Emma Daly, to discuss how war reporters reckon with ethics and the effects of combat on their domestic lives. Here's the moderator, Dart Center Executive Director Bruce Shapiro.
Our three panelists tonight are all experts in the art of difficult storytelling and are kind of in an ineffable, they'd never met until tonight, but they're in a dialogue with one another through the very nature of their work. To my immediate left is Donald Margulies, who is the author of Time Stands Still. He's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Dinner with Friends, numerous other plays, Model Apartment, Collected Stories, which will be done later this season by Manhattan Theater Club, Sight Unseen, which also starred Laura Linney, the star of Time Stands Still on Broadway, and much else, very much worth seeing, reading, and talking about. He also teaches playwriting at Yale University. To Donald's right, your stage left, is Emma Daly, now the communications director for Human Rights Watch, and in that guise being one of the principal spokespeople, outward-facing voices for human rights advocacy in our world. But she brought to this job many years of experience as one of the leading human rights and war correspondents of our time for The Independent in London and for The New York Times, covering conflicts from Central America to Kosovo and elsewhere in the Balkans and many places in between and otherwise far flung. And on her immediate right, your far left, Santiago Lyon, who's the global director of photography for the Associated Press, himself a distinguished photojournalist, led the AP in its own Pulitzer Prize several years ago for its photojournalism in Iraq, breaking news photography. Santiago also is a veteran of some of the great conflicts of our time before he went behind the desk, and we'll probably talk about that. It's not irrelevant to the subject of tonight's discussion and to the subject of Donald's play that Santiago and Emma are also married. They have to one another. To one another, yes. And we don't expect marital secrets to be laid out before all of us. But since that's part of the backstory of this play, and since it's part of the backstory of what journalists who cover war and violence and conflict and tragedy all contend with, it's especially wonderful that that dimension can be brought into this room, and we're grateful. This is going to be a conversation. We'll talk a bit about the play. We'll talk a bit about the issues that come up in the play, journalistic, political, philosophical, and otherwise. We'll see where the conversation goes. For a while, we'll kind of keep it to the panel, and then we'll open it up to conversations from questions from the floor. When we do questions, I would ask you, first of all, to make sure to line up behind this microphone so that your questions can be heard and recorded. Please identify yourself, and please, A, keep it a question, and B, keep it short so that everybody who wants to participate can. I'm now going to move into full conversation mode and move down there. I felt it was necessary to kind of stand up and welcome you all here. And there is, by the way, still food and drink in the back, and you should stay around afterwards to have more of it and talk with one another and with our panelists. I think what I'd like to do is start, Donald, with you, and just talk a little bit about Time Stands Still, how and why this play came to be written, how and why it came to be about journalists and these particular journalists.
You know, it's one of those mysteries of creative writing. The play was a commission from the Geffen Playhouse in Los Angeles, and I was stuck writing a play. I spent about 3 years writing a play that I ultimately shelved. And I was riding Metro North one day. I live in New Haven. And I was just sort of writing notes to myself in my notebook. And I wrote a new play, and I underlined it. And then I thought, Aloft. And then I started asking questions. Who lives in this loft? And I decided that it was a photographer who lived in the loft. And then I decided it was a female photographer who lived in this loft. And then I decided it was a female photojournalist who lived in this loft. And this is how it happened. It really did happen in this kind of self-imposed game, a creative game to help me get out of a particular rut that I was in. And I found that I wrote a play called Dinner with Friends that was produced 10 years ago and really seemed to click with audiences, that seemed to touch on something that I could never have predicted. I feel that that's happening now with Time Stands Still, where I did not have an agenda. I didn't know what I was taking on. But as the characters began to take life, and I began to ask questions about them and their relationships and where they'd been and what had happened to them, the play began to take hold. And it does seem to have touched on many themes of people's lives, not just the war and the violence in the world and the catastrophe in the world that's so much a part of our daily lives, but always in the background. But it's also about how people relate to one another in that world and the choices that people make, and how relationships change over time. And those are things that have always interested me in my writing but have never quite taken this form before.
And we should say, since not all of you have seen the play, that the two central characters are female photojournalist Sarah, who's played magnificently by Laura Linney in the Broadway production, and her partner James, who's a writer, played by
Brian Darcy James.
Mental moment there. And then their editor and his new partner, Eric Bogosian, Lisa Silverstone, come on stage and interact with them and bring out various facets of their life together, provoke some action in the play. But you started with a woman in a loft, a photographer. A writer came into it. Mm-hmm. And both of them had been to an unnamed war, though we presume Iraq, or one of our wars. Both of them suffered terribly. One of them, the photographer, comes away from the war at the beginning of the play with a terrible physical injury. The other, the writer, emotional injury.
Mm-hmm.
Why'd you split it up that way? How did that happen?
Well, you know, I was very, well, as a dramatist, I always look for ways to raise the stakes. And in the case of Sarah, I felt that she began to emerge to me as a very strong, very complex woman, the kind of women I like in life and the kind of women I like to write about and the kind of woman I'm married to. And I thought that if there were certain obstacles in her way, that it would give me more to negotiate as a writer, you know, more strategies to come up with. And I decided that she has been dealt this terrible physical traumatic injury. I didn't want James's story to be precisely the same as Sarah's story. Although they come from the same experience, I wanted there to be a different backstory there. I wanted there to be a different schism that might have occurred between them before this catastrophe. And that schism turns out to be that James suffered his own trauma, but a psychological trauma, in the weeks before Sarah was struck by an IED. So they each have their own myriad afflictions, but they are both people who have endured horrific and painful, physically and emotionally painful moments.
Emma and Santiago, maybe Emma, start with you. You are, like Sarah in the play, a woman who's been to a lot of dangerous places and built a career on that. And you're also a person who, like all the characters in this play really have, as people do, faced important choices about that work and about career and all of that. How did the play resonate for you, and what did you come away thinking? And what, as you listened to Donald, what are you thinking?
I mean, I think Donald got a lot of things, you know, very right about the experience of being a journalist, you know, in a far off and dangerous and difficult place. I think probably one of the first things that comes up in the play, and it's the question that everybody, you know, has to deal with, is why are you doing this? And the Alicia Silverstone character poses this very, in a very sort of straightforward manner. You know, how can you bear to do this? How can you see all these terrible things? And of course, the character's response, you know, actually changes over the play. But there is this whole dilemma between, you know, are you there just to bear witness for its own sake, or is there some other purpose to you carrying out this role as a journalist? And, you know, I think the fact that I now work at Human Rights Watch means that, you know, I made a change precisely around that question. But, you know, I did work in Central America, but I think that the war in Bosnia was really sort of my formative journalistic experience. And I think there's a whole sort of Bosnia generation of journalists who went through that war who grappled with that question. I remember at the time having conversations where with other reporters saying, you know, at least we can say, you know, because of us, the sort of politicians in power right now, John Major, Bill Clinton, these people, will never be able to say what we didn't know in the way that they had in the past. So that was almost, you know, the best that we could hope for. Well, you know, we're there and we're recording these things, and so at least, you know, they can choose not to act, but at least they can't pretend ignorance in not acting. Mm-hmm. But I suppose over time, for me, that wasn't really enough. And, you know, when you're there and you're trying to report very difficult things, you know, of course it's difficult to sort of dissociate yourself from what's going on and, you know, to sort of say, I mean, you can say just the facts as well as you can determine them in your reporting, but it's very hard to maintain, you know, an emotional distance from the situation. That doesn't mean that you can, you know, that you can't do an honest job of reporting what it is that you see. But for me, it just felt like there was an obvious follow-on, which was, we don't just want to record this, we want this to stop. Right. You know, we don't want this to go on. And we still, I think, you know, argue and debate amongst ourselves how much effect we actually had. You know, in the end, the war was brought to a halt. You know, NATO, the UN and NATO did intervene. I can't remember if it was NATO at that point. Or, you know, the sort of Western powers did intervene and stop it. But, you know, then there's lots of sort of follow-on from that as well. But it's not clear how much of a role we had to play or not. But I think it's something that every reporter struggles with when you're in a situation like that.
Santiago, when we talked about this the other day and you'd just seen the play, you said essentially there were certain things that it got really right that you hadn't thought a play was likely to get right about journalists in these situations. What did you have in mind?
Well, you know, there were times when it was like watching strangers act out parts of my own life, which I thought was very effective. And, you know, thank Donald for doing such a good job. I think there are many things. The tension between the couple, her sort of coldness, dissociation, sort of emotional numbness to a certain extent, his guilt
that he hadn't been there when she was injured, his own invisible injury, you know, just a whole series of things that brought back into sharp relief components of, you know, my own experiences, our own experiences, I think, to a certain degree. So I thought it was, you know, these things, I stopped doing that line of work over 10 years ago, and yet it's still very much in my mind. And I think when you go to these places and see things and do that sort of work, it marks you in a certain way. And I think that, you know, a decade after the fact, to go see a play in Broadway and to have it bring back these things is really testament to the importance of the issues that are dealt with, not only on an individual basis, but also in terms of recognizing that people who go and report stories, people who, journalists, you know, they play a crucial role in our societies, but it's not a role that they can play and come away from unscathed. And I think a lot of attention is given, or has been given historically, to the effects of war on the military.
Right.
You know, shell shock, battle fatigue, going all the way back to sort of, you know, Achilles and that type of thing. But the business of the effects of war on journalists is a very new area of concentration. I think Dr. Anthony Feinstein up in Toronto was one of the first people to really perform clinical surveys and analysis and to really analyze what the effects of that line of work are on journalists. And I think it's particularly relevant nowadays when you have, you know, a war winding down in Iraq, a war winding up in Afghanistan, and, you know, numerous other conflicts and situations around the world, in an era where mass communication is, you know, we're bombarded with information in a way that we never have been before, yet all of that information is being gathered by people. So,
Donald, one of the interesting things for me about watching these people who I felt I knew too on stage was that they defied most of the literary cliches of journalism. There's of journalists. There's a fair, a big sort of vocabulary, a big history out there of portrayals of journalists, mm-hmm. You know, mostly falling into either lovable rascals, sort of the front page, or just nobly dogged Woodward mm-hmm. and Bernstein diggers, and a few other variants on that. You did something a little different. Did you consciously fight against those cliches, or did these characters just emerge?
You know, I let me say parenthetically that it's very gratifying to hear your responses to the play, because when I was working on it, I wanted to get it right. Not that I was doing a docudrama. That is not at all what I was doing. But what I was trying to do, and this is responding to your question,
yeah.
I wanted to create three-dimensional characters as if they were people we knew. I mean, that was really my objective as a playwright, was to create characters. And something that I've learned and something I've practiced, you know, for instance, if in my play Sight Unseen, the protagonist is a painter, but that doesn't mean he talks about art all the time. It doesn't mean that he talks about painting all the time. There are other issues going on that define him, not just the work that is, you know, sort of the stereotype of who that person is. So that in creating these characters, I foremost wanted them to be believable. I wanted us to believe them and identify with them. And I think that what people are responding to in the audiences are not so much the, you know, the truths about journalism, but really the truths about how men and women relate to each other. You know, people have told me that my plays are elbowing plays, where one member of a couple is elbowing the other one. and I took that as a tremendous compliment, because the moments in the play that I think that make it larger than a play about journalists, is that these are little truths about relationships and universal moments. That's what motivated me to write the play more than it was to have a political agenda. I don't have a political agenda, but I do want to be rigorous in what I'm attempting to show. I have a lot of friends who are journalists, who I love and who I honor, and I wanted them to feel that this was it. I didn't want them to sit and watch the play and say, no, that would never happen. In fact, I involved my friends in readings of the play, and Bruce read an early version of the play for me. We're friends. We should disclose.
We are friends. Fair disclaimer.
Yeah.
Neighbors.
But I gave it to journalist friends to vet for me because I was very concerned that I was lapsing into assumptions as opposed to revealing truths. I emailed my friend Ethan Bronner while I was working on a rewrite, and I said, would journalists stay at the American Colony in East Jerusalem? And he wrote back, yeah, that's a good bet. You know, that kind of bet. So, you know, just those kinds of details I wanted to get right. You know, for instance, that moment in particular, in an earlier version, Jamie just talks about this hotel where we met. And I thought, well, no, everybody knows where they met their loved one, and I just need for this to be as specific as possible. So that's when I had this exchange with Ethan, just to give you an example of the kind of, you know, picayune vetting that I did do. But that attention to detail was very much a concern of mine.
But in that attention to detail, you do capture, I think, and those of you who've seen the play, I think, would probably agree with this. As Emma said, certain types of personalities, the flinty toughness of Sarah and Jamie's greater is a kind of vulnerability that's different, but both of them seem to be somewhat wounded people. And that leads to the whole question of not necessarily why do you do this work, which is the question that Mandy asks, but what kind of person does this work in the first place, which a lot of us think. Emma, do you want to talk about that? You told me a story the other night. It was interesting.
Well, there's a line where I can't remember which one. I think it's he says, let's stop running away.
Yes, he does.
It reminded me of of a night in Sarajevo at the Holiday Inn during the war where we had dinner. There were about 12 people having dinner. And this is a group of people, some of whom you might have had very intimate experiences with, but about whom you probably actually know very little, because you tend not to have those discussions about where you grew up in those situations. So for some reason that night, we went round the table giving everybody's biography, and the bits that I remember were, well, my mother died when I was 12, and then my father kind of sent us off to live with my cousins, and we went from aunt to uncle. Well, my father left, and then my mother and I lived in the car for 6 months. Another one said, my mother died when I was a baby. And it sort of went round like this until eventually one of my friends said, yeah, and then my brother killed himself. And everybody just burst out laughing. And it was just the most ridiculous sort of collection of stories that, you know, if you made up, it would just sound so ridiculous and over the top. And of course, there was one guy who said, in the middle said, God, I'm really sorry. My father was an executive who wasn't around much, but that's as good as I can give. But I think that, you know, in sort of who does this in the first place, I don't think you can say that, you know, one group of people, you know, are attracted to do this. So there's lots of different kinds of people who end up, and different characters who end up there for all sorts of different reasons. I myself got into it kind of accidentally, but I think there is one.
How did you?
Well, I.
Before you tell that story, let me just say I've been advised by my spies in the back that we need to move the microphones a little closer so that people can hear.
Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry. Before I get into how I got into it, I think those experiences can help explain why at least some people are there, because I think that, you know, one of the things that people always ask is, you know, is it dangerous and sort of why are you going and putting yourself in harm's way? Well, if you have a sort of visceral experience early on in life that tells you that really bad stuff can happen at any time, in any place, you know, outside your front door, in your home, wherever, then sending yourself off to a place that's dangerous by other people's standards suddenly doesn't seem as stupid. Because if you can get hit by a bus and killed, you know, on your own street, then, you know, sending yourself off to a siege isn't as crazy as it can sound.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, I went to Central America because my, I was just finishing university and I went to visit my parents and there was a small English language paper and I ended up working for them and it was the time of the Central American peace process and then I worked a little bit in Nicaragua and Honduras and then the Panama invasion and then I got to know lots of the people who were doing this for major papers and then when I moved to the Independent I somehow had become associated with all the people who covered war and so I was somehow perceived as somebody who could cover it even though my actual experience of, you know, conflict was limited to the invasion of Panama, you know, which was not very dramatic, and a few other situations that were really not, you know, very, very serious. But I somehow was perceived as that, and because I was willing to do it, I then got sent mm-hmm. to cover mm-hmm. these assignments. And by the way, back in the early 90s, there was no hostile environments training. There was certainly no thought. There was very little thought to physical security, let alone psychological security.
Santi, how did you get started in this? It occurs to me that I don't know.
Well, I sort of grew up in it. My father was a wire service reporter for UPI, for United Press International, and in Spain. And my earliest memories are sort of in the newsroom. And I remember at about the age of 9 or 10 getting interested in what happened in the darkroom. And the photo editor of one of these agencies, I can't remember if it was UPI or AP, brought me into the darkroom, and he was a terrible photo editor. And he could never make up his mind about which pictures he wanted to send. So he would make prints of several pictures, and then I would stand up on a little stool and look into the developing tray there, and he'd say, "So which one do you like?" And I'd point, and he'd say, "Fine." And that would be the picture that got sent. And then that sort of morphed into what really was a, I think less so nowadays, but certainly back then, a sort of an apprenticeship process by which you learnt this almost as a trade. And you couldn't advance further in the profession until you've mastered certain elements of it. And so in photography, that started with, you know, writing captions. And after you could write a caption, then you might be allowed to develop a roll of film, and then you might be allowed to make a print, and then you might be allowed to actually go do an assignment. And it sort of morphed along like that until I decided that I wanted to go see what was going on in Central America in the 1980s, which was a, you know, center of world news, and it went from there.
But, you know, one of the things that both Jamie and Sarah have in common and Time Stands Still that we haven't talked about is a pleasure and excitement at the intensity of life in covering war. That clearly appealed to both of you as it does to Donald's characters. How do you understand that now as you kind of look back on that and at yourselves as younger journalists, that intensity?
I mean, for me, I really, you know, feel that. I mean, this might sound very strange, but for me, the experience in particular of being in Sarajevo for 2 years, or being based there, I mean, I went out, but I would always come back, was that it really showed you, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And it really showed you the best and worst of humanity. I mean, there were some extraordinary people there who lived utterly heroic lives, you know, in the way that they made sure that their elderly neighbor of a different, you know, creed actually, you know, was able to survive because they brought her food or they brought her water, which was, you know, something you had to risk your life to do. And, of course, the sort of, you know, just the evil of the kind of wanton killing and torture and the kind of gratuitous cruelty. And the sort of intensity, I mean, in a way, it's almost easier to cover the stories when you're actually inside the war, because when you're in a war zone, because, I mean, obviously there's the sort of adrenaline of survival and escaping, you know, escaping sort of near misses or, you know, death or injury that, you know, can really kind of fire you up and that allows you to deal with all the sort of the misery. I mean, to be honest, one of the hardest stories I ever had to do was after we'd been in Kosovo and the bombing began and we had to leave, and we went around and spent almost 3 months on the Albanian side interviewing the refugees coming from the fighting. And I found that much harder than actually being in Kosovo and sort of, you know, trying not to drive over landmines and sort of dodging, you know, hiding in a ditch while people were firing over you, because it was just, it was this unrelieved misery where you were just listening to the most horrible stories over and over and over again. And you were in no danger, but it was just, it was much harder to cope with and to absorb than where you were getting up every morning and, you know, you had a mission to get out there, find out what was going on. You had to get around the roadblocks. You had to, you know, get through the day. You had to find a way to get there and get the story and file and get back.
Sandy, I mean, you were, I know I can talk about this, you were injured in Bosnia. Like Sarah in Time Stand Still, you went back. You went back to work. How long, and did you think hard about it, and why?
Well,
and what did you think about as you were looking at Sarah, I guess, is the other interesting thing.
Oh, I understood her completely. You know, I was injured. I was lucky that it wasn't a life-threatening injury. It was a sort of a flesh wound, I suppose. And when I was recovering in Madrid, in Spain, I was actually based in Cairo at the time, but I went to Spain to recover because that's what I was calling home at that time, sort of emotionally, and lots of friends and family and whatnot. And all of my friends and family kept visiting me. I was on crutches, and I was sort of, you know, convalescing. And they kept visiting me, and they kept saying, well, let that be a lesson. Don't you think that's enough now? And I was furious. I was a little annoyed at them for not understanding what I was going through, but I was furious with the notion that, you know, an injury like that was going to take me out of the game. And I was determined, really extremely determined, that I was going to get back on my feet and get back in the game. And I did, and 5 months later I was back in Bosnia working. And I think that speaks to, certainly in my case, but also to cases of many colleagues I know, that level of determination and focus and passion for what we do or what we did back then, where, you know, people talk about bravery, and people talk about being cool under pressure, grace under pressure, and being, you know, keeping a cool head. And for me, certainly, I think it was more about intense concentration. You knew in your own mind what you had to do, and you knew what you had to do sort of physically to get it done. And that was a point on which you concentrated almost to the exclusion of everything else. That's not to say that you were foolish. There's a lot of sort of minimizing of risk and weighing up of odds and chances and a lot of worst-case scenario thinking where you're really, you know, trying to figure out, well, if this goes wrong, what's the worst thing that can happen to me? But that really laser-like focus on the task at hand, combined with the sort of the exhilaration of, you know, living in a place where your life is in danger, where dramatic things are happening, and I think under the umbrella of believing in what you do and believing in the value, the intrinsic value of what you do. So all of those things combined, you know, are what make it happen.
Can I just add to that? I mean, I think there's also, you know, you talk about passion, and there's for a lot of people, especially when they're going back to the same place over and over again or living there for a long time, you know, there's a commitment to the story and to the people, and, you know, it's going off to a place like that is a very quick lesson in perspective. So, you know, not to minimize anybody's experience, you know, when you're surrounded by people who can't get out and who are surviving on significantly less than you, your life suddenly looks a lot better. But there's this sort of that kind of commitment to the story, but there's also something that Sarah refers to in the play where I don't think she says I depend upon the suffering of strangers. I think she says I survive on the suffering of strangers.
I live off
the suffering of strangers.
I built a career on the suffering of people I don't know.
That's right. And so that's something that, you know, is I think one of the real difficulties that you're confronted with always, which as a journalist, especially in a place like that, which is, you know, the kind of basic equation is, well, the worse it is for them, the better it is for me, in a way. Not for me, but for the story.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a really, you know, I mean, there's you talked about his guilt. I mean, there's the sort of survivor's guilt, but there's also that, you know, guilt that really you know, that you are making your career on that, and how, you know, how is that payback going to come, or how are you going to repay that in some way?
There's also another, so there's that ethical conundrum, which is ultimately unsolvable, and the characters in Time Stands still find it insolvable. There's another kind of dilemma as well, which involves the local journalists and translators and photographers and fixers, the journalism biz call them, who outside journalists work with. And in Time Stands still, there's a particularly important relationship, which is the sort of spring of the plot, watch spring in the plot. But both of you have done important work with fixers and local journalists. And Santiago, in your case, you're now a photo editor responsible in many cases for the safety and well-being. How do the ethics of big North American, European news organizations and local journalists and the engagements that us have with them, how has that changed? How does it play out?
Well, I think the first thing, there has to be a very clear understanding of what the mission is, I suppose. And in some countries, journalism is or has developed very differently than it has here, let's say. And journalism is often, you know, a mouthpiece for governments or for oppression or a tool of regimes or if not that, it can be very partisan one way or the other, very polarized. And so I think what Western news organizations, certainly American news organizations, bring to the table is a very clear desire that anybody who's going to be associated with them understands that this is not about partisanship and this is not about taking sides. This is about being fair and objective in as much as that's possible and balancing both sides of the story and trying to tell as complete a picture as possible about what's going on, not just one side of the story or the other side of the story. Now, sometimes because of the circumstances, it's not possible for one individual to tell both sides of the story. So in those cases, we try and make sure that we work with people, you know, who are telling all sides of the story. And of course, for me, the local journalists and the fixers are the real heroes and the real brave ones, because they, more often than not, don't have the option of getting out of there after 6 weeks or 2 months or whatever the length of the assignment might be. They have to live there. And because of that, they can fall prey to all sorts of intimidation. And, you know, we see it all the time in countries like Mexico and Colombia, where journalists are targeted and assassinated for what they write. So it's a very different proposition for them. And like I say, those people are the real heroes of these stories, I think.
Oh, I was just going to say, and as a foreign journalist, I mean, even if you do speak the language, which in, you know, a place like Bosnia, most of us didn't, you know, you're completely dependent on your fixer. I mean, you just can't operate without them.
Yeah. Santiago, you're also, as an editor now, you're also in the position of Richard, Sarah and James's Sarah's editor, photo editor in the play, who's played by Eric Bogosian. And now when terrible things happen to people on your staff, as happened, I guess, last August, one of your photographers was blown up, lost a leg, do you try to talk them out of going back?
No. I think there has to exist a certain level of respect, professional respect and personal respect, and you have to respect people's decisions. Now, that said, you can certainly offer advice, and if you see somebody who may be not very self-aware of what they might be proposing or getting themselves into, you can, intervene to some level. I think what my experience in the field offers me in this role as a manager or a leader of a department of individuals, who by the very nature of their work are putting themselves in harm's way on a daily basis, is a very vivid understanding of what they do and what they go through. And I think it's understood by them that they have a sympathetic ear should they need assistance, should they have difficulty processing their experiences on that level, and obviously, physical assistance if somebody is injured or wounded, that we're going to make sure they're looked after.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things about the play for me, Donald, is that this is a play, it's not only a play about journalists and about war and marriage in general, it's also a play about people of a certain age who face career change and really mm-hmm. life change, mission change. Both the central characters face the same choice to continue the way in mm-hmm. which they were, to go back to over there, or to try something else. And they make a different choice. How did that come to be in the middle of the play? How did that choice come to be so central?
Well, I was looking for contrasts. To dramatize. In the play, James, who has spent many years being a freelance print journalist, has made a choice, which is that he's not going to write about this stuff anymore, and he focuses on culture writing, if you will. He writes about horror movies. And Sarah, angrily says to him in the second act, why do you watch this shit? And she says, so you've replaced real horror with fake horror. And it seemed to make a lot of character sense to me that would be what James would choose to do. He's still writing, but he's still processing images of horror. So, that felt like a good and right transitional choice for him. Sarah's journey is a little less certain. And, some of you have seen the play, so you know that's the case. But, I remember, and I'm blanking on the man's name, but when you and I had an early conversation yeah. about this, you had told me about this British photographer.
Oh, Don McCullen.
Don McCullen.
Yes. Yeah.
Who was so shell-shocked. But he didn't give up photography. He began taking photographs of landscapes, still life. And I thought that was such a beautiful metaphor. But this is how this man has maintained a certain kind of tenuous equilibrium, because he seems still shattered. But he still is connected to his camera. And this is the way he has navigated through the world after his years of trauma of covering horror.
Interestingly, Don McCullen this year went back to Darfur and
did, for the first time,
the kind of human rights photography or war photography that made him famous. I haven't read any reflection by him on this or how he came to this change, but yeah, for many mm-hmm. years he photographed nothing but bleak British landscapes after being one of the defining photographers. Well, no, not all British landscapes are bleak, but his were. but, you two also have faced and made changes that, like the characters in the play. Santi, you're behind a desk, and Emma, you're now doing human rights advocacy in a different way. Talk about how those changes came about, what went into them.
Well, I think it was much easier for me, and that's why I like the fact that Sarah is the female character. Because in my particular case, after Kosovo, there was a slight lull in conflicts around the world for a brief time before September the 11th. And it so happened that I had a baby. And, you know, if you're a woman and you have a child, then everybody assumes immediately that you're going to stop going off to crazy places. And in my case, it just, I didn't even make a conscious decision particularly. It just sort of worked out like that, and then I found that I was okay with that. I have friends and colleagues who've made a different decision. They've become mothers and they've wanted to carry on. And they, you know, have to counter quite a lot of opprobrium or the very least questioning about how they could do such a thing and why they would dare to sort of be such bad mothers. Interestingly, the men who become fathers and not given any such out, the assumption there is that fatherhood won't really change their life at all, and they can carry on because they have a wife to take care of the children, or, you know, a partner. And so it's fine for them to carry on. And I know I can think of at least a couple of friends and colleagues who would really like to have stopped doing this, fathers, and who can't really find a way out, in part because they're very much identified with what they do, because there isn't that much work out there if you're a photojournalist, or if you're, you know, if you've spent years specializing this and becoming very good at this, then doing something else is just practically difficult. You know, it can be hard to find somebody who's going to pay those bills, and once you have children, then you have more bills. But for me in particular, there was that sort of withdrawal into you know, more sort of standard kind of foreign corresponding, which I did in Spain for the New York Times. And then, you know, we moved here and I became a freelance, and then the Human Rights Watch opportunity kind of arose out of nowhere, and it was only when I was offered the chance that I suddenly realized that it was sort of the perfect place for me to go.
Yeah. Santi?
Well, I think the most difficult thing I've ever done, without a doubt, of anything has been to stop. And, you know, I've been through a lot of dramatic things and difficult things, but stopping was by far the most difficult for the very reasons Emma mentioned. It had become an integral part of my identity. It was very compelling, almost addictive, and at some stage I became very tired of the whole thing, the whole combination of stress and of losing multiple friends and colleagues over the years, and just a nonstop diet. I mean, for 10 years essentially, I was doing, you know, war, disaster, famine, conflict, and other things too. It wasn't an exclusive diet of that, but there was a lot of it. And I decided to stop, basically from one day to the next. I think I just sort of cold turkey said, "That's it. I've had enough of this stuff." And the pressures were quite large. My employers, or at least individuals, colleagues, myself, I was sure, but I wasn't sure. And the next couple of years after that were excruciatingly difficult. I was sort of aimless, and what was I going to do with myself? And in fact, it was that led us to come here. I was lucky enough to get a fellowship up at Harvard and spend a year sort of reflecting on what to do next, and then that morphed into this job.
But you have continued to work with war photographers, and you also continue to be dedicated to images, but now in a much more safe way. One of the amazing things in the play, Donald, and especially in this production, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is there's a moment, without being a spoiler, toward the end of the play when Jamie comes into the apartment and this guy who's been taking risks all over the world comes in wearing a bicycle helmet. Right, the ultimate symbol of not taking a risk anymore. Nick, do you wear a bicycle helmet now?
Oh, absolutely.
We have children.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And in fact, a friend of mine who also stopped during this line of work was riding his motorcycle the other day and was silly enough not to be wearing a motorcycle helmet, and he fell off and did himself a fair amount of damage.
But also this is also a play about people who are telling stories and making images, as everyone at this table is. And in that way, it's like some of your other stuff. I mean, Sight Unseen is also about this. This is a persistent theme for you. Why?
And it beats me. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it just seems that I keep coming back to certain ethical dilemmas of the artist that befall the artist. A lot of the stuff that I have been writing about, and it's almost like a triptych now, almost Sight Unseen, Collected Stories, and this play, all deal with a question of who owns a story, who owns an image. That certainly is what happens in Sight Unseen. A painting becomes the bone of contention. In Collected Stories, it's a personal story that is revealed and then used by another writer. In this case, it's a sense of or a fear of exploiting others to feed a career. So I think the dilemma or the conundrum of being an artist and being a participant in society and an observer of society at the same time is a theme that I do seem to keep coming back to in different ways.
Well, and that's a living conflict for any journalist, right? Who owns the story and whose story are we telling? I know I've had subjects of stories I have written that I thought I treated with great respect come back on me because somehow I stole their soul. I stole their story. Whether I got it right or wrong is almost irrelevant. There's a sense of being ripped off. Emma, you're laughing.
Yeah. In wars, especially after they drag on for a while, you can certainly, it's very common for people to start saying, well, why should I talk to you? You know, you guys have been here for this long, nothing's happened. Why, you know, I'm going to stop talking to you because what am I getting out of it? Nothing.
We could probably go to a conversation with the rest of you. Anyone have any questions? Something to throw into the pot? I'll come back around with some other stuff for you guys. But come on up to the mic. Just identify yourself for purposes of recording and then ask your question.
Hi, I'm Henry Stern. I have a premise that nothing happens accidentally in a play. Everybody's lines and every situation that the audience knows about has a purpose. Am I on solid ground there?
Yes, there's nothing arbitrary, if that's what you mean. Nothing arbitrary.
The only character that we know anything about her background is Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know anything about the early lives of any of the other characters. And Sarah came from a dysfunctional family with parents that were fighting with each other and made a very difficult childhood for her and encouraged her to keep her distance from them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that enter into her decision to choose career over interpersonal relationships at the sacrifice of her marriage and anything else?
Well, I think it...
One more question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. And, Sarah gulps when she hears that Jamie has established a more normal relationship after his breakup with her. You know, she's affected by that. By that, are you saying that you're making a value judgment as to the decision she made? You know, has she consigned herself to a less than happy life in the future?
I don't make value judgments, and I certainly hope you don't feel that I do, because I don't. I don't judge my characters' motives. You're very right that I don't delve into the backstory of the characters. There are a couple of clues about Sarah's upbringing. We sense that she comes from privilege in a dysfunctional household, and that scarred her emotionally, so that she fears marriage, she fears commitment, she flees to find a kind of identity for herself. All of those things are there, and you're absolutely right. It's no accident. It was a conscious choice on my part that I didn't want to give everyone a story and, you know, sort of a dossier. I simply wasn't interested in doing that in this play. It's not to say I don't do that, but it seemed irrelevant to me. The story that I was telling seemed to belong here and now. And people don't suddenly go off and tell stories and reveries and reminiscences. The choice that Sarah makes is very much hers. She owns it, and I have no value judgment to make.
Can I just add to that that, frankly, I would say that we need people like Sarah, because I can think of a number of journalists who really have dedicated their lives to their work and have continued that sort of intense focus, you know, at the expense of a more conventional private life. But, you know, thank God for them, because I'm not capable of doing it. So I'm glad that some people are.
Yeah. Someone else out there with a... Yeah, please.
Lisa Linden, I was just curious. You chose to make Jamie's next relationship with a Cambodian woman.
Mm-hmm.
And watching the play yesterday, I thought of Sid Schamberg, and I thought of The Killing Fields and Dith mm-hmm. Pran, and I'm wondering if you did when you made that choice.
No. I didn't. But I will say that it seemed right to me that Jamie's next choice was a person of color. It just seemed that way. But no, I wasn't channeling Sid Schamberg.
But, you know, that does bring up the question of relationships and their relation to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you two are married journalists, which is not a universally successful model. Without kind of violating any boundaries, but thinking about how work and relationship, and how, as in the play, over there where there's all this action, and back here where there's quiet and safety and in some ways the bigger challenges that come with not just living moment to moment come, what are some of the ways you balance that? How has that worked?
We crack a lot of jokes, as do the characters in the play. You know, it's. I mean, when you're, I think it's. This is not just true of journalism. I mean, anyone who has a very intense job that's very emotionally consuming as well as time consuming. You know, the idea of the sort of question of whether you're more likely to have a successful relationship with someone who does the same thing or with someone who does something completely different.
Right.
You know, you can answer either way. I mean, from my point of view, I think that, you know, it helps because you can understand, you know, perhaps more readily what the other person's going through. And, you know, I mean, I have friends who are in a different situation, and one of the questions I always wonder about is, you know, if your partner doesn't have that sort of first-hand experience of what you do and what you go through, you know, how much do you tell them about what you're going through? And I have to say that I was very lucky that he decided to stop when he did, because it would have been just extraordinarily difficult for me to have gone through him being out in these places while I was at home. So I'm glad I didn't really have to deal with that. But I think if it were me, I would always want to know. I would much rather hear the really horrific, gory, and terrifying details mm-hmm. than to not be told and to have to sort of imagine them. But I think a lot of people don't want to talk about those things and feel that they're, you know, that it's too painful or too damaging to do that to the person they love, who, after all, is back home. I think I would find that very difficult. I would rather know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's an interesting struggle about what to tell and what not to tell that plays out in Time mm-hmm. Stands Still, right? Where mm-hmm. Mandy, the Alicia Silverstone character, who sort of represents the rest of us who are trying to understand this world, on the one hand asks for some information and then is presented with it and recoils, really can't handle it. Mm-hmm. So the question of how much people can bear
yes.
is something that, as journalists, you guys deal with, in your practice, how much detail to put into a story or which images to show and not show. Mm-hmm. But it also occurs to me that you deal with this in plays, too. You have to struggle with how much of the difficult things that go on between people
right.
to show. I
mean,
right. in this play, there probably was some difficult stuff that was on pages ended up on the floor.
Yes. 15 minutes worth. So that's a lot of geschrei.
Yeah. How, I mean, when photojournalists are looking at pictures, they make value judgments about how much gore is necessary or distressing, mm-hmm. or when we're writing our stories. How do you sort that?
Well, you know, I do believe it's the same in your profession. I'm sure. You use your best stuff. You know, if you have something that somehow crystallizes an experience that you're trying to convey, you will use it. And somehow it's diminished if there are too many such details, because it then all sort of blurs together into the landscape. So when you isolate these moments, and I'm talking about little behavioral moments or even a joke, that is what I choose to do, is the strongest moment. Not that there are various moments, but that there is one that somehow encapsulates all of them.
Well, when you when the Jamie character describes what sort of pushed him over the edge, I think it was where he had the,
yes.
the brains of
yes.
a woman in his mouth.
Yes.
It was horrifying, but I think you used it very judiciously.
Thank you.
It wasn't too much of that, and it would have become numbing or horrifying and wouldn't have been as effective. And I think it's exactly the same thing in journalism, where if you shock, in many ways you're failing in your mission as a communicator.
That's right.
If it's horrible and repulses people, whether yes. it's a picture, whether it's a gory, too vivid account, then it's not effective.
But it's not always possible, is it, to know what that is? I mean, Santi, you had the very difficult experience at the AP with a photograph of a U.S. soldier. That was very controversial, mm-hmm. and that was precisely over: is this moving too far into the zone of shocking, or is it a necessary image?
Yeah, that's true. What Bruce is referring to is last summer we had a photographer embedded with the U.S. military in Iraq, essentially living and working with them in Afghanistan, rather, with the U.S. Marines, and she came across a scene where a young U.S. Marine corporal had been mortally wounded in a firefight, and she made some pictures of him as he was being attended to by his colleagues. And because of the rules under which we embed or work with the U.S. military, we're not allowed to send those pictures out until their next of kin have been notified. We considered what to do with these pictures while that process was going on, and it led to a very interesting and lively debate internally at the AP because of everything that it meant. In other words, here was a combatant who was identifiable, who was American, who was young, who we knew where he came from, who we went and met his family, and this was a real human face on the cost of the war over there, on the one hand. On another angle, we felt a very strong journalistic duty to show that side of things as part of our job about informing the real cost, about the real cost of the war, not just reducing it to numbers and statistics, etc. Another angle was, of course, the family, who were not at all keen to have this picture of their son distributed. Also, the Secretary of Defense and people in the Pentagon were not at all keen. And so we had this very vigorous debate. And in the end, what we did was we didn't use the picture by itself. it became the seed for a much more robust and broader, more thorough package of journalism about everything surrounding that incident, who this kid was, the photographer, what her emotions were as she was taking the picture, her journal, the circumstances under which she died. And once we had that package, sort of complete package of journalism ready, we made the decision to go with it. And it was very controversial, but ultimately I think that it, a good measure of its effectiveness was in some ways the controversy and the thought that was, provoked and the dialogue. It was a successful piece of journalism because it got people thinking and because it got people passionate about something that if it hadn't have been sent, this young man would have been another statistic. So it's that sort of thing. Now, if we had chosen to use the picture just by itself out of context, then I think we would have been quite rightly perhaps accused of sensationalism or voyeurism or however you want to describe it.
One of the many things I like about Time Stand Still is that it shows journalists having these very lively ethical debates, which we do have and which very rarely get portrayed in that way. It's an interesting thing. I actually see that. One of the things I looked at on stage, like, yes. Yeah. Anyone else have a question? Yeah, please, come up to the mic.
Hi, Monica McCarthy. I wanted to ask you a question that Mandy asked Jamie and Sarah after Jamie finds out, or James, sorry, that his Iraqi story is not going to, about refugees, is not going to happen or be told. And she says, but what am I supposed to do with this information? You know, me, an ordinary person. And she gets really upset that they won't let themselves just feel the joy and enjoy life. And I just, since you guys were on their side and now, I mean, you're still very involved, but have been able to make a life and have a family, if you can maybe answer that question from your perspective.
Can I just say that killed me, because at Human Rights Watch we started reporting on Iraqi refugees very early on. We had a hard time getting that,
really?
That story picked up. So I felt his pain about that. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand her. I mean, I have had those moments where, especially as I get older, and having been a kind of news junkie my whole life and a news consumer as well as a producer, you know, of just wanting to say, you know, I sometimes I feel like I just don't want to know. I just want to shut myself off and not know about these things because it's too painful, and you know, for what? And then, because of my history, I'm saying, no, you know, it doesn't matter. You have to know. And what the thing to her is, you know, you should be living the life that you want to live. And that's great. I have no problems with her choices at all. But what I want you to know about these things, because I actually do want you to make a difference, because I think that if you do know about these things, then you are in a better position to change them, whether it's, you know, just the way you vote, whether it's that you just vote in an informed, or you just vote, that you vote in an informed way, or that, you know, you start a mommy blog in which you actually, you know, think about what parenting is like, I don't know, under those circumstances. I mean, it's difficult because I can really understand her wanting to ignore. But I guess I also feel like it can also throw the joy into sharper relief. I mean, you know, you can certainly be extremely grateful for what you have, and I guess that's partly what I meant about, you know, being a lesson in perspective. Mm-hmm. It can at least help you to be glad for the things that are good.
But that's also the other side of that moment, and it's a remarkable moment in the play, is the particular devastation of a journalist when she realizes that something that she believes in and has worked on is not going to see the light of day.
When James does.
And in my experience, in a lot of the work we do at the Dart Center, for a lot of journalists, it is those stories that are the most haunting, the ones that people...
Yeah.
Anything come to mind for either of you?
Oh, yeah. I had a case once upon a time where a photographer had made a picture of a very dramatic situation that he felt was very important, and for whatever reasons, the picture was never used, and this fellow became obsessed with it. I mean, you know, just on and on and on, and it really, really upset him, because he'd risked his life, and his mind almost. It was a pretty horrific situation, in order to do this, and he felt so impotent and so empty, because all of his energy and focus that we were talking about before had gone into this particular thing, and there was nothing to show for it. That picture has never seen the light of day, and it's crushing for him. And so,
is he still in the business?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's still in the business, and testament to his fortitude and to his engagement, you know, he's finally, after a long time, gotten over it, and he's now back in the fray, and he's going to keep going. So
I have a story about after the bombing in Kosovo, when NATO went in, we went in, and you could meet all these people who you hadn't been able to see before, and I met these children who were three siblings and a cousin who were the sole survivors of a massacre in which 45 people had been killed, all of them relatives and friends of these three children. And thanks to the Kosovo journalist we were working with, you know, I went and I talked to these children, and then I immediately did the story. I mean, I went and we went to the houses that they lived in. We retraced. They got rounded up by sort of unknown forces at the time, taken off to the local police station, held there for a while, and then taken back to this kind of communal garden where their houses were around. And on the way, they stopped at a cafe. They peeled off the old men and shot them in a cafe. And, you know, all the bloodstains were still there. And then they took them off to the garden, and they killed everybody else there, and the children were wounded and sort of fell under, and, you know, these things happen quite often, and they reloaded their clips. I mean, it was a real... And then another unit of sub-forces came and actually administered first aid to the children and ended up sending them to hospital. One of them actually went to Belgrade for treatment because she was so badly wounded. The other three were in hospital in Pristina and were... There was this amazing story about the mothers were killed, but the fathers had been off in the hills, and so the fathers, somebody managed to get a note to the fathers about to let them know, and when the war was over, they managed to get to the hospital and get reunited with their children. And I still feel guilty about this, the one good thing I did was introduce them to a woman I know who works for the International Medical Corps, who's a child psychiatrist, and she works in war zones dealing with children and trauma. So at least I did that. But, you know, I took the story to the British military police in that area, and they were going to open an investigation. And then I just, the editor at the time wanted a short, just a sort of news story about it. And I said, no, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do like an 800-word story or even a 1,000-word story about this. This has to be a sort of magazine piece. And they just didn't really want it. They just weren't really interested. And I didn't have the kind of resources at that time to push on it and to fight back. And I ended up letting it slip. And then luckily there was a whole sort of follow-on where actually somebody went and found them afterwards, and they ended up testifying. They ended up having a war crimes trial, and this girl actually testified, you know, years later, and the people involved in the massacre ended up being convicted. And, you know, the BBC made a film about her because they'd moved to England. So in the end, these children actually had, you know, a relatively happy ending to the story. But, yeah, it was a terrible moment, and especially because I felt like I should have done more to fight for it.
Anyone else have a question? Yeah, please.
My name's Andy Arkell. I've just finished as security advisor to the New York Times in Baghdad. after 3.5 years. Just to pick up on something you were saying, Emma, right at the start, which is about bearing witness or more. And there was something you said that really struck me, which was part of the sort of motivation for you going on reporting was trying to say, we want this to stop. And I wonder what happens to that when the conflict is different, like the conflict in Iraq was very different. In fact, it was dreamed up in this country and was sort of perpetrated by this country in many ways. And I suppose my question is, what should happen for journalists with dissent? Because I just found when I was working there that I tried to read the articles that were being produced, and they seemed to me as if some key ingredients were being styled out of them somehow, sort of moral outrage or dissent or disagreement. And they seemed sort of oddly uninnocent. All the coverage seemed boring and didn't seem to be talking about the city that I was living in. And I suppose now, as I'm trying to find a way of telling my difficult story, I'm wondering what should happen in the storytelling process to that dissent.
Well, you know, to not to be flip, but I started off in the British system before moving for a couple of years to the New York Times, and in the British system it's somewhat different in the sense that, I mean, rather unfairly, an old friend and colleague of mine, an American journalist, once said that every American news story had to include the phrase, quote, "the obvious is indeed obvious," close quote, said a Western diplomat. And that the British sense was more that you were supposed to tell us what it was like. So, in fact, and I think that there are kind of arguments being made for both styles, but I think that in the British style that I was working with at the time, there was more space to sort of to write stories in which you could say this is outrageous or strange or something, to have some kind of emotion. And that the system here is much more about sort of pretend, you know, wanting to keep that out. But on the other hand, I actually hate some of the things that the British press publishes, because I feel that they've crossed the line way too far, and in fact all you're getting is opinion and you know, somebody's idea about something and not much of the rigorous reporting that you would actually want to sort of sustain that.
She's been Americanized. It's hopeless.
No, but but there's some stuff that I find outrageous that it's published without any, you know, sort of sourcing, and you know, the headline is very exciting, and then as you read the story, there's no there. I think, you know, obviously, I mean, Iraq is just more complex in general, because so far as I can tell, nobody has a great idea about how to make it better. There, it seemed simpler. Wasn't, as you see, with the peace process, but...
Well, I think, like with any profession or with any sort of category of work, there are different types, different genres, different qualities. And so what you get in a, you know, a 400 or 500 word newspaper or wire service story is by its very nature going to be limited and have to leave out certain things. What you get in a 10,000 word magazine story is going to be a little bit more complete. What you get in a well written book is probably going to be even more satisfying. I think there was a piece which you may have seen, I think, in today's or yesterday's New York Times about the amount of writing that's been coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it was called The Well-Written War. Fascinating in that soldiers and journalists and all sorts of people involved with the conflicts are really producing very interesting, very insightful bodies of work with really quality, well-described, well-written information that paints a very complete and robust picture of what's going on. The question then, of course, is, well, how widely are those things read? How, you know, and so is there a compromise between sort of massive distribution and quality? Sometimes there is.
But let me push both of you, and actually maybe push you first on this, Donald, because the question really was about telling difficult stories. Mm-hmm. And you're an expert in telling difficult stories on stage, characters who have very difficult choices, backstories, stuff. And the question was, what do you do with your dissent, which, I mean, mm-hmm. isn't just do you think the war is right or wrong. What do you do as a writer when a story, the story that you're telling, that you feel compelled to tell,
right.
evokes distress, outrage, and anger? What do we do with that as a storyteller? How does it fit in?
This is going to sound pretentious, but I'll just say it anyway.
It's okay. It was a pretentious question, really.
Okay. you know, when I tell these difficult stories, I mean, we have to sort of, you know, put this in perspective. My difficult stories are all domestic stories. They're nothing global about them, but they are universal, and they are certainly the stakes are extremely high for whoever is on stage. What I try to do, and this is the pretentious part, but what I try to do is tell the truth. And I think that I have a responsibility as a dramatist to tell the truth. I think audiences know when you're not telling the truth, when you're skirting the truth, or you're being flippant, or you're being reductive, or you're not being rigorous. You're not telling the whole story. And I think that when I present an argument, I'm debating with myself. And, you know, that's something I can do on stage that you don't have the luxury of doing. But I do that on stage where I present A has an argument and B counters it. And then A has to respond to that and then B to that. And this is how I build conflict, because these people are in disagreement. And yet I have to invest in each of their points of view equally.
And that's why fiction can be truer than nonfiction.
Although as journalists, we also do, we come up with our surrogates, right? We come up with our Diplomat X says and Diplomat Z says and so on. Any other question? Josh.
That's a really interesting comment because it made me think of something. The idea that Americans would know when you're skirting the truth or editing something to create a somewhat fictional story. Recent studies showed that Fox News is the most trusted news name in America, and I just wanted to know how that meshed with your thought that Americans know when you're skirting the truth and can sense what's real and what's not.
Well, you know, I guess I'm talking about a subset of Americans. I'm talking about people who go to the theater.
I mean, go to the theater.
People who go to the theater.
Subset.
Yes. I have the same incredulity and outrage that you do about that statistic. But I am talking about people who are choosing to go to the theater, you know, who have a certain appetite for conflict, for intellectual conflict. Yes, hopefully one is providing an emotional component, but what you're describing is a terrifying notion, of course, that people are accepting that as truth. I mean, this has become so much a part of our national nightmare of this culture of ignorance. But that's, we're getting into something else completely. But go ahead.
Well, except it's you know, it's sort of a cousin of Mandy's desire not to know, in a way. I mean, you know, I should really watch more Fox News, but I think one of the things that strikes me is that they're very good at delivering sort of simple, you know, they're very good at delivering the message in a very simple way. And that's much more attractive than being told, you know, it's just really complicated and there's this person here, but then, you know. So, you know, I do think it's actually related.
I'm going to ask one more question of each of you, and then we'll wrap it and call it an evening for time to hang out and talk informally. But Sandy and Emma, let me ask you something that's relevant to the end of Time Stand Still. Toward the end of Time Stand Still, a couple of young children make their appearance in the script. One is an actual infant, and the other is a perhaps stepchild to be up here. What are you going to tell your kids, or what have you told your kids about the work that you've done?
Well, it's interesting.
My daughter, who is 8 years old and is very curious and lively and a great reader and just a, what am I going to say? She's a wonderful little girl.
No, but it's true.
But it's true. She noticed the other day a scar that I have, and she said, "What's that?" And I didn't feel that it was right to hide anything from her. So I, you know, I told her what happened. And, you know, it's hard to know how an 8-year-old processes that kind of information. But I was very upfront with her, and she asked a few questions, and then she moved on to something else. So I think in my case, I absolutely want my children to know what I did with my life, at what age or at what stage they're going to be able to process it and make sense of it, you know, and that's probably something that will change as they develop. But I do want to, at some stage, get my act together and sort out all my papers and put them in order and so that they can have a narrative of the physical remnants of my work, my pictures, my, you know, the stuff that I did. I think that's very important for any parent.
On the other hand, we don't watch TV news around them, and we don't really talk much about the news. I mean, when it's something like Haiti that's so big and so pervasive, we do, you know, talk a little bit about it. But we're still, you know, and now it's starting. I mean, the election was the first thing she was really into and she was really interested in. But I think we still try to protect her from what's happening in the world. And I'm sure that will diminish, you know, as she gets older. The little ones, our son's only 3, so it's less of an issue. But I did tell her, I said, "Oh, yeah, we're going to be on this panel tonight." And she said, "Oh, really, can I come?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." And she said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "Well, because, you know, we're going to be talking about, you know, some kind of, you know, grown-up things and some difficult issues. But it's about, you know, it's about the kind of work that Daddy and I used to do." And she was like, "Yeah, I think you're right. It sounds so boring for a year." That's right.
Donald, the final image of the play, especially in Daniel Sullivan's beautiful Manhattan Theater Club production, is of the now solitary Sarah preparing for an assignment and picking up her camera. Is that a hopeful image?
I think it's a realistic image. Whether it's hopeful is arguable, but I think that her choice is what she feels is her place in the world. And I, in that sense, it is a positive ending because, you know, but again, I'm showing the, you know, sort of the collateral damage of such a choice and the sacrifices that are made and the compromises and the choice to be solitary, or at least for now.
But I think that's the key. The key to me is that it was her, that it was a choice.
Yeah.
You know, it was not that she was left alone and, you know, had nothing better to do.
Right.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, a good place to end.
For more about the Time Stand Still event, including a video interview with Santiago Lyon and Emma Daly, go to dartcenter.org.